This is The Pulse. I'm Bharati Jagdish. Thanks for joining us. President Halima Yacob, in her address to open the second session of the 13th Parliament last Monday, said that Singapore's leaders must not take the wrong approach in making incremental instead of bold changes. She noted that the fourth generation leadership is taking shape and the leaders are conscious that Singapore is at an advanced stage of development. Now, this is what she said exactly. I'm quoting here. We may feel that we have more to lose now. We may be tempted not to go for bold changes, but instead be content to tweak things at the margins. That would be the wrong approach, she said. So, in which areas are bold changes needed today? I'm joined by Member of Parliament Denise Pua and Chief Editor of Digital News at Channel News Asia, Jamie Ho. First of all, Denise, I understand that the MPs are going to be talking about this, bringing up ideas along this theme next week in Parliament. What can we expect?
Well, I think the president's call to ask the 4G leadership to be bold and not just tweak, it's an appealing one. And I think many of the members of parliament, in fact, members of the public and the media are also talking about this theme. I think that's good. You'll hear many ideas. We, of course, have to calibrate a little bit to make sure that we're not just trying to be bold for bold's sake and that we are able to add some wisdom to the boldness and to ensure that even as we provide many ideas and suggestions, that we are able to also ensure that there's some ability to find ways to execute them well, because only then can lives be better, lives can be transformed. And also, I think the ideas must come together also with the knowledge that government is no longer the only dispenser of wisdom and or public service, that many of us on the ground, the private sector, the people sector, all of them can contribute. And only through collaboration, only through greater buy-in, only through doing things together, then life will be much better for the rest of Singapore.
The problem is, though, with anything bold, there will be apprehensions. And at times, quarters of the ground have gotten the sense that bold changes will not be made because there's just too much fear of losing what Singapore has already achieved in various policy areas. How are you reading this theme, Jamie?
As I listen to President Halima and her references to boldness, I of course also remembered that some of the parts of her speech, and it was known that the 4G leaders themselves had some input into it, and therefore I also saw it as themselves sort of making some commitment to these bold changes. And as a consequence of that, I was wondering whether or not that was a signal that they themselves also may have felt that, have we sort of not taken the opportunity to make some of these bold changes in the past? Or are we saying that actually with some of the larger global forces, changes in the economy, that it's unavoidable that we will have to make very significant jumps in mindset, in courage, as far as policy changes are concerned. But I agree with Denise that at the end of the day, it's not just boldness, not just for boldness's sake, but also that they have to be quite clear that this will involve everyone. Singaporeans should take this in the right spirit, that this calls for bold sort of mindset changes for themselves too. How they get involved, how they have actually a role and a say in how policy changes are thought of, for example.
Whether or not all Singaporeans can accept it is a different issue, though. Even though I think a lot of Singaporeans feel that, yes, this is what we've been waiting for, bold changes in specific areas. But let's face it, you know, you're going to differ on those things as well. There is still some skepticism on the ground, though, about whether change will really be bold enough to satisfy some of the desires of Singaporeans on the ground. But like you said, Jamie, I think we have to note that it was the fourth generation ministers who drafted the speech. They must believe it to put it in the speech. Denise, in which areas are you confident we might be able to see some bold changes going forward?
I believe that in the areas which are critical, especially for the next gen, what we see in terms of disruptions in the economy and the social landscape, those are, it's not what I wish to see, but I think what I think Singapore really needs to have in terms of changes and bonus. One of which, for example, is education. We all know that education is an important tool for social mobility. Sometimes we are a victim of our own success and that the children of the past have been benefited from meritocracy, for example, are themselves getting to be a lot more, having a lot more access to resources versus others with who are less advantaged. I think in terms of inequality, in terms of access of equal opportunities to school, to education, to even things that could be a result of our new world, digitalization, for example, I think these are areas and gaps that we need to look at. We have no choice but to look at to ensure that everyone, as much as possible, must be as close as possible at the starting point, and they
but,
have an equal chance.
Efforts have been made in that regard in the last few years. Why are they still inadequate, you think?
We do need, like what Jamie said, we need to look at some of the mindsets and study carefully what are some of the restraining forces. The driving force, of course, is that the 4G and many of us, you know, the populace who are a lot more educated and vocal, want to see better equality and so forth. But we need really to peel the onion and look at what are the restraining forces, what are the mindsets that are still restraining us from achieving what we want to achieve. For example, if we are still very interested in competing and comparing, and this stops us from wanting a major change to the system or to be bold and change the system, then we need to address that fear and that gap, perhaps propose other measures by which we can change the situation.
Yeah, I entirely agree. And I would use education as an example about how when you talk about bold changes, it's bold changes in mindsets and not just therefore from the government and policymakers, but I think especially in something like education, the bold changes must also come from parents and how parents see the role of education and how things have changed since they were in school as well. So because let's use the example of the PSLE. So obviously parents have always pointed to PSLE as one area in which bold changes can be made. The government has been trying to tweak it at the edges in terms of scoring formulas and things like that. But if you don't, if individuals and parents themselves don't entirely change the way that they view examinations, they view tests and they view assessments, then no matter what the government does, it will always sort of default back to what it used to be, a high stakes, high stress focus on academic credentials, for example.
But surely if some changes are made within the academic system, it could influence people to think a different way. And one of the changes you've been advocating, Denise, is PSLE. You say scrap it altogether. Have
yes,
a through train
and
system.
There's a group of, quite a large group of Singaporeans, some of whom are even educators, who actually support this view. And some parents literally came up to me and say that, and we will support you and we will put our children in these schools if it happens. But we also know that as surveys were made, that there's also quite a number of families and some even some educators who were very unsure about scrapping the PSLE. What do we go for? And so I think it's not an either of. We probably should address the fears and needs of both parties and see if we could boldly suggest a pilot, you know, and if it's successful, you know, and if it doesn't compromise academic rigor at the same time, help us to give a holistic, a more joyful learning experience for our young, could just pilot it, you know, and make sure that it does well before we go all out to just boldly scrap the whole system. So I'm for piloting and making sure that people who are not yet sold or who are still with an old mindset or have a lot of fears will know that, you know, this is something that is possible, especially in this age of skills mastery, lifelong learning. We're still going on the old school of thought that, you know, if education is just about crossing that milestone of PSLE, GCE, the university, and that's it, or maybe go on to do a PhD and master. I think that is really old school. And this landscape of education has changed. The demands of the employers, employment, enterprise have all changed. And so education is one area that we all need to agree, not just government or leaders or 4G leaders, but also our 4G people to agree to say, okay, if there's some sense in this, let's pilot it, let's try it, let's be open-minded about this, you know, and see if it's successful, let's scale it.
The thing is, you've been on about PSLE for a number of years, but every time you bring it up, the ministry says, no, the PSLE is a useful checkpoint. In fact, more recently, Minister for Education Schools, Ng Chee Meng, former Minister for Education Schools, Ng Chee Meng, said that removing it would only transfer the stress on parents and students elsewhere and make the O and N level exams more stressful. Do you see the point in that argument, Denise? They've been giving you these reasons for
years. I have my views of what education should be, and I've seen systems. I saw a number of systems whereby I saw children, some locals, you know, in a couple of school systems where the the students are very self-driven. They're not competing with each other. They're competing versus a standard. The model I saw was, you know, some of these students are able to meet the requirements, entry requirements of local tertiary institutions and foreign institutions as well. So I've seen, of course, in many other parts of the world where there are 10-year systems, and even in China, I've mentioned about Alibaba founder Jack Ma, who started a system of, I think, 12 years, but making it pretty progressive in terms of ensuring there's technology in it, there's character building, there's the arts and music, and just a full education. And I have so much faith in Singapore and the Singapore system that if we put our heart to it, we will succeed, and we can do it, and we can even craft a system or design a system that is ahead of everybody else. You know, we're small, and that's a strength as well. If we could pilot, we could scale, we could be successful, we could be really ahead of our game, and I think our future is a lot more secure.
But the fact is that more recently, the Ministry of Education has said that, in its addenda to the address actually, it said that it will continue with its efforts to dial back the overemphasis on exam results. But they only went as far as to say, by changing the PSLE scoring system, and we know, we've known for some time now that that is due to happen, and by enhancing applied and experiential learning in schools. Clearly, you feel
those
this isn't bold enough.
These are announcement directions that already have been mentioned. For example, this year, you don't just change it within a few months. So I believe that even as that is happening, I believe the 4G leadership has the sincerity to want to say, try, and perhaps, you know, I'm waiting for the right minister to pilot this, you know, some alternative models.
So they have to go
but
a step
further. But they also mentioned that there are alternate pathways, alternate models. So I'm still optimistic that there's some way to go, and that actually we have no choice but to ensure that our education can match the future world, the world of the millennials, the world of the new digital economy, the demands of skills that constantly changing, where shelf life, product shelf life, service shelf lives are so short. I'm convinced that there's no other way to go but to change, in fact, even more our education system and our pathway. Mm-hmm. So our current system of having, example, preschool, kindergartens, primary school, secondary school, and high school and so forth, or pre-U, I think we may really have to look at our infrastructure and see if there's a need to even sit down together with the citizens. I mean, nobody has the monopoly of ideas anymore. Mm-hmm. And see what's possible, what's innovative, what's creative, and what's also realistic, what can we do, you know, to implement and make some changes. So I think there's no other way but to continue to have this conversation, but dive deeper into real models and piloting and so forth. And I think that's where I have a lot of hope for that and optimism for that.
But my sense is, actually, ironically speaking, is that I think most people also recognise that despite the flaws in our system, and let's use education again, that basically our system does actually work. We actually have a good, very good system by and large compared to other countries. It's brought us here. But because we have such a reliable system, that there is therefore a lot of fear. I think there is ultimately some deep set fears as well, that while you have a good system and you know that it has to go somewhere, and that fear therefore is making too bold changes, or changes where you don't know where the roads will lead to. So there's a lot of uncertainty as well, which then would explain why we can only maybe consider tweaks to the PSLE example for now. Because I think the government knows, I think the population knows that PSLE actually, despite all its stress, actually is not too bad. It's gotten to where we are. But
it's then made us academically very excellent. But are we developing the love for learning? Are we developing skills that
I think people know that we want to get in that direction, right? So the question now is how to get there. And I think there is, therefore, my point is that there is a fear in as Denise said, I think nobody wants to be just bold for the sake of it and then just ditch
don't
the
fix
whole
it
thing.
If it ain't broke.
Yeah, so that's I think what's holding back a lot of people. It's holding back maybe policymakers, holding back maybe parents. Because if I, let's say, have a kid who is in primary 4 or primary 3, and I know that there's a PSLE out there, and I know, okay, if he does well in the PSLE, he'll get to a good secondary school. But if you tell this parent now, by the way, I'm going to ditch it altogether, it's going to be some form of a through train into Sec 1 and Sec 4, they will probably greet it with a little bit of trepidation and fear.
So that's why the devil is in the details. So I think we have discussed...
You're saying that it can be a rigorous process, even without PSLE.
I've seen it. I'm very convinced it can be done. And I think one pull factor will be the economy of the future, what's required in the marketplace.
Okay, so instead of PSLE, what would we have? We would have a through train system if we went by your wishes, right, Denise, if we went by the model you're thinking about?
I think we have to really look at the curriculum, you know, on mm-hmm. what kind of curriculum will be useful for the new age. If we have saved time through all the prep work, you know, for mm. high-stake exams, how are we going to use that time? And we have to really look at some features of the new economy. We have to look at features that are useful in other school systems and so forth, and create and customize and design a system that's suitable for us.
So small give me an country. Example of what would work. Illustrate for me some of the things that you have seen that you think could work in this environment.
I think that we need to speak a new language, for example. Literacy, for example, is not just about numeracy and English. It's a lot about, example, is coding. Even if coding is just one of the things that can change, even can be disrupted. You know, it's coding a new language. How do we learn things that will help us to improve our computational thinking, things that will help us build our character. We can spend a little bit more time in the arts and the sciences so that we can integrate and really come up with a more interdisciplinary kind of education, more holistic.
And not
how
to say there'll be no exams.
For example, not at all, not at all.
There will be some assessments.
Yes, how do we ensure that the resources are arranged in such a way or are packed in such a way that each of us can learn in our own pace? Mm-hmm. That if we are faster, we can pick it up, we can be more self-driven. There are systems by which, or computer systems by which our results are tracked and so forth. And I've seen it in a manual system, and I'm quite sure with the help of technology, we can do even faster. So I'm quite excited, actually, and I believe that, and it's not just about digitalization or computers, it's really about also enjoying the arts and knowing, and even community service. It's not a once a year, I happen to do once a term kind of service, but if we look at systems whereby it's more inclusive with schools within schools, we have partners, and we could do community service on a daily basis. Just recently, I've been in a negotiation with a school to see if we can put entire social enterprise and with the student leaders themselves
as part of the deal, even
running and managing the enterprise, and everybody from principal to student. Every one of us are so excited, and we will announce that later. But I just think so much more can be done from using the time that we can save from both children and their parents preparing for exams.
One of the concerns, though, on this issue has been that if you don't sort students based on their academic ability, they will not be able to survive in mixed ability classrooms. But I also know that you have seen models like that succeed.
Yeah, we've spoken a lot about that, about bending and so forth. We have multiple intelligences, right? So if I'm just average in terms of numeracy, mathematics, for example, then I'll probably do a standard or basic, you know, but I'm really good in some other areas or computers or in the arts or so forth. Then I can take a higher level in terms of that. And this is not even new, because at the
primary level,
tertiary level, people do that. You select a basic, you select a core, and then you go on to do advanced courses and so forth so that you can dive deeper into your strength. So I think we can actually translate that down a little bit to younger age. So these are deeper conversations that we need to have so that we can move on from PSLE or no PSLE and so forth, and really what are the other data points and information and resources that we need to look at, the developments we need to look at to ensure that our Singapore system will always be, you know, useful to us, but also, you know, can be actually ahead of the game in the global stage.
Any other aspects of whether it's policy in other areas or education that you think need a deeper look?
Yeah, I think, and it's starting to happen, for example, in aging, looking after people with seniors. The fact that we are starting to maybe be a bit less siloed and focusing on community, for example, the recent efforts by MOH, for example, to look at aging and what the aging population needs, you know, and making some structural changes, putting the senior activity centres together with the health centres and looking at it as a holistic solution. I think those are some directions that we need to look at. The traditional silos of ministries and so forth, I think we should examine it and see if we need to make some changes to that. Again, if you change everything with no government ministries, I think some people will feel very withdrawn and lost, you know, will have some withdrawal symptoms and get very lost. But I do think that we do need to focus on communities and see if there are needs to restructure the way we organize the public service, for example. The other thing that I thought would be worth looking at is really to, in an age where information is so accessible and ideas come a dozen a dime, everybody has their views and suggestions, you know. But the real bonus is in the ability to translate visions and ideas into action and into actual results. So I think we need to give a lot more premium to people in the front line, people who actually execute ideas and making them happen, and not just having a think tanks at the top with just policy development without ensuring that we track the results and then fine-tuning, you know, as a process. So I think the way by which we, whether in corporate or people sector or public sector, look at policies and how policies are translated to outcomes and how we value and place premium, even pay people in the front line who implement things. I think we need to pay them at a premium as well to ensure that execution excellence and results are also, the people who are involved in these are also valued very much. Mm. You know, and so I just feel that it's so much excitement, things that we can change for the better. For example, you know, even the blue collar workers as a population, are we willing to, if we're unwilling to do jobs like this, you know, are we willing to pay people more, you know, even as we learn to value these jobs more? And so I think there's a lot more to discuss as to what we see in the future generation, not just by the 4G leadership. I think it's old school to think that if anything goes wrong, then it's all the government's fault. I find that not sufficient. All of us need to be part of the solution.
Exactly.
And
you've got to make people,
including government, has a monopoly of ideas. So I think the whole mindset that Jamie spoke about is something worth really looking at. And to the extent that we can make changes to some of our mindsets, I think that's the extent to which we can succeed. Aging, for example. You know, if a 92-year-old politician can make a change and be, you know, very clear in his views, and then I think aging is not equivalent to being not very useful. No, you can still add value even if you are at old age. So I know of a lot of old people with very young mindsets, always excited to learn. But I also know of a lot of young people who are behaving like they're so old and they're so stuck in their mindset and never learning anything new anymore. So
you talked about the 92-year-old politician, and we know who you're referring to, of course, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad in Malaysia, who has recently become Prime Minister. The same can be applied, of course, to political leadership in Singapore, wouldn't you say? You know, age shouldn't be a factor. That's one way to set the tone.
I think it's not age as an chronological age and a biological age. But I think it's the age of thinking. Yeah. If you have a politician, and I'm not saying whichever party is from, a political leader or even a government leader who is, despite his biological age, is very young in his thinking, constantly learning with new ideas and proven to be so, you know, then I think we should not think they should leave the scene, resign or step down or retire just because of their biological age.
Jamie, anything to add on managing an aging population?
Well, again, I think the mindset changes that we're talking about, Denise, is I think also, I think over the years, and I think I wonder whether it's a cultural thing or a social thing, that over the years we've also subconsciously sort of lowered our own self-confidence of what our slightly older, in chronological terms, population can contribute. And I think even within themselves, sometimes over time, they have also disadvantaged themselves in terms of what they can do, what they can contribute. And they sort of figure out that, you know, I'm old, therefore, you know, I should just retire. You know, this is my lot in life. You know, I'm just going to do this. If you suggest that they work, then again, people sort of get negative about it. Say, hey, why are you asking the older folk to work? Mm. So I think over time, it is hard. We need to break out of that, both as individuals, as a society, to actually think. I mean, as Denise said, I mean, he's 92 years old. He's still doing this. I wish when I was 92, I'd still be A, alive, B, working.
Alive can already.
Yeah, exactly. Let alone leading a country. Exactly.
Yeah. Contributing.
So it's amazing. I would like to believe that I'm still working at 92 and not retiring and still contributing. I think once people take on a little bit more self-confidence in their abilities and in contributions, that is one major step in terms of changing mindsets.
Income inequality is a major issue in Singapore today and in many other countries as well. I understand, Denise, you have something to suggest in terms of taking care of the vulnerable in Singapore.
Yes, I think after all, we are not a Singapore company that is going for just financial results, and that would be a terrible country to be in. And we know that even as we value the old, the 92-year-olds who are able to add value, there will be some who will be ill, who will not be healthy enough to contribute to the economy. There will be some who are born disabled or have special needs, and as a result need a leg up. So I think that as a country, as a leadership, we do need to ensure that we need to look after the sons and daughters of Singapore, whatever, regardless of their abilities, regardless of their how they turn out to be, regardless of whether they are able to contribute to our bottom line and GDP. So there'll be some in the society who always need a leg up, and we can only consider ourselves human if we, you know, make sure we don't ignore them, you know. And
so
I'm thinking of some mindset changes and policies as well. We're always thinking that only if people can work, work. And indeed, you know, work should be the first measure to help people to feel, because work is dignity and identity. But for people who can't work or cannot work as much or fast, is there a way that we can change or transform our thinking such that we ring fence, for example, some positions or jobs for them, you know, so that indeed they can come out of the homes, you know, their homes, be part of society, be seen and heard as well, and not because they are considered not very useful to the economy or society, all of them should be kept at home. I've done some research on this. There's a company, a cosmetics company called L'Oreal. What I found out is, of course, this is a big company that is into logistics and distributions and a lot of digital systems that help them to do that. But they have intentionally, purposefully ring-fenced jobs. You know, some of them are packing jobs that could be easily replaced by robots and automation, but they have ring-fenced it because they want to make a difference in this landscape in society for this group of people. And they actually had factories, for example, I heard in there's a factory in Taiwan that they call the happiest factory in the world, where folks with special needs and disabilities actually go every day there to work. You know, they were trained to work, and some of them could give very good outcomes, some not very, but they all are able to lead something meaningful. And I thought this was quite appealing, this kind of approach where we ring fence and we make purposeful policies to include them. Mm-hmm. Housing, for example, what can stop us from ensuring that within one block of flats, units that would be given just for people who are disabled, so that the block of flats there, the neighborhood could help look after them. You know, there are just so many social workers that we can come up with. You know, we have a very tight labor force. But if all of us make it a point to contribute and to do it on a daily basis in our neighborhood, I think what kind of beautiful world that would be. I really believe that if Singaporeans put our hearts to it, we can come up with a vision like that. We can realize that dream.
So don't just criticize. Think about how you can contribute as well. The skeptical people on the ground will say, I'll think of how I can contribute. I will make a suggestion, but no one will listen. And it won't get implemented. Just as, oh, now they're talking about bold changes, but are they really going to make it? So what do you have to say to the people out there who are skeptical about this? Jamie, first of all.
I think it's always easy to speak from the sidelines, right? And I think, again, the boldness comes from believing that each one of us, if you really want to make a change, you can. I don't think everyone needs to be like someone like Denise, who has gone from one place to another just by sheer ability to implement, for example, and then become involved in politics and then be able to implement through there. I don't think everyone needs to believe that that's the only way that they can contribute. I think they can contribute in many, many different ways, at the smallest levels, in your own home or in your own neighborhood or in your own block of flats. I think it can be done. And people just need to be a bit more confident that these bold changes can come from within. It doesn't have to be such huge steps. They need to believe that it's not true that only people who can implement and make change are the people in politics, for example. I think everyone needs a little bit more self-empowered to believe that they can.
So do some pilot programs in your own neighbourhood and see how that goes.
No, Denise? I truly support what Jamie said, because, of course, I've seen people who are very strategic and they do big things, but I know of many people who are what I call ordinary heroes on the ground. We start where we are in our seasons of life. We don't have to wait until we are retired. We're rich, we have money, a lot of money in the bank to be able to serve and to help, to be part of the solution. So I'm a born optimist, and I believe it can be done. And I think that if we truly, genuinely want to see a better Singapore, then all of us, 4G leadership and the rest of us, you know, we all need to be willing to just put in whatever we can in our season of life, what we can contribute and be part of the solution.
Thank you very much both for joining me today. And hopefully this marks an era of bold changes to come in Singapore. And as Denise said, if you have ideas, go on, make them heard. Do that pilot program, just maybe within your neighborhood or school or workplace, and see how that goes. Thanks very much, Denise Pua, Member of Parliament, and Jamie Ho, Chief Editor of Digital News at Channel News Asia, for joining us today on The Pulse.